Attacks on abortion rights and trans women, as well as a new attempt to reassert traditional gender roles, have become modern day catch cries for the far right. Yet women have resisted and this year have played leading roles in the struggles for democracy in both Thailand and Hong Kong, have been central to organizing and leading the Black Lives Matter movement in the US, and have led an incredible pan-continental feminist movement against state violence in Latin America. So despite politicians lauding this as the best it's ever been, this sort of resistance shows that there is still much to fight for. So in this vein, I want to argue a socialist strategy for women's liberation, based on the idea that it would require nothing short of a revolution, actually a total transformation of the way that society is organized. But in order to fight oppression, we have to first understand it. So I'll discuss the origins of women's oppression, which I'll argue have a basis in the class-divided nature of society. Because women's lives today are actually a world away from their counterparts in the 1960s. Back then, equal pay was legitimate, divorce restricted, and abortion totally outlawed. Women in the public service were forced to quit their jobs upon marriage, and the idea that rape could actually occur within a marriage was not recognized until the 1970s. So today the situation could not be more different. Women have formal legal equality in most of the Western world. We make up 50% of the workforce in advanced industrialized countries and have achieved higher representation in political office and boardrooms. Brutal imperialist wars are launched on the basis of liberating women today. A far cry from the soul-crushing boredom of homemakers in the 1960s, women in the 21st century struggle with the conflicting demands of waged work, childcare, and a whole range of responsibilities in the home, the notorious double burden. While the nature of sexist ideas has changed, the ability of capitalism to adapt itself according to be what is profitable is timeless. There are whole industries that exist on the basis of women's oppression. Think of the beauty industry, which finds every year ever more creative and insidious ways to stoke women's insecurities and exploit them for profit. This industry is worth $6.5 billion annually in Australia. Or take advertising, you know, an industry that relies hugely on sexist stereotypes and the objectification of women to turn profits for a handful of capitalists. So despite the gains of the women's liberation movement, sexism runs rampant. Neither the advent of a privileged social layer of women into the establishment, nor the prevalence of women in a workforce still subordinate to capital, has actually brought structural change or equality. It has accentuated, rather, the class divide between ruling and working class women. Women's oppression endures because, despite some reforms, capitalism has weathered the challenges of the radical movements of the 60s and 70s. So the understanding of women's oppression as structural means that any strategy seeking to challenge it must aim their fire at the capitalist system. For those who want to fight for women's liberation, they must take seriously the only social group capable of challenging the system, which is the working class. But before I make the case for a socialist strategy, I want to look at exactly where sexist oppression comes from. So rather than being something innate, women's oppression has a material basis in the class-divided nature of society. This can be a controversial argument because it can seem to undermine women's own experiences of oppression, because it is the case that sexist behavior is perpetrated by those around us. It is the men in our lives who are statistically the most likely to perpetrate violence. But despite what their experiences might suggest, it is not simply individuals who are to blame for the continuation of women's oppression. The subordination of women is, of course, not unique to capitalism. It has been a feature of society since class divisions first emerged some 6,000 years ago. All systems of class rule require oppression to justify inequality. The racist myths about Asian and African people around the time of colonialism and used to justify the Atlantic slave trade come to mind. With the arrival of private property came systems of inheritance necessary once a small minority had control of production and the privileges that came along with this. This involved the imposition of monogamy on women and strict limitations on female autonomy, which is why Engels wrote back in 1884 that capitalism has ushered in the defeat, the world historic defeat of the female sex. So what makes capitalism different from other class societies is that it has the illusion of being freer and fairer. The majority of people are free to work for a boss their entire lives, never mind that they'll become destitute and face starvation if they don't. Yet the difference today is that the ruling class don't rely on sheer force to sustain their rule. We live in the most unequal system, actually, in human history. And so to justify this, the ruling class makes use of an extensive ideological apparatus. This includes not only fundamental institutions like the education system and mass media, but also liberal journalists, academia, and even the family. Marx and Engels wrote in 1846 that the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. And so what are the ruling ideas of today? You know, that oppression is the product of human nature, that women are naturally subordinate and caring, that human beings are brutal, violent, and oppressive, and that all revolutions end in tyranny. So women's oppression is the thread that binds the capitalist system together. It rests on two key pillars, women's direct exploitation in the workplace and the privatized reproduction of labor power in the family. The profit motive goes deeper than attempting to just sell women products to make them feel more attractive. Capitalism relies on the theft of value created by workers, most of which turns to profits in the boss's pockets. So capitalists are concerned with people working as cheaply and as hard as possible. A compliant and subservient workforce is the dream of any capitalist looking to ensure profitability, and a workforce where half the workers accept lower pay and worse conditions, as in the case of women, is even better yet. Women make up half of the workforce in Australia, yet are still underemployed, underpaid, and most likely to be in part-time or casual positions. Healthcare and education, the two key industries employing women, are also the second and third most low paying in the entire economy. Throughout their lifetime, university educated women can expect to earn 1.5 million less than their male counterparts with the same degree. So it's true that women constitute a large and greatly underpaid section of the workforce on a whole. The weaker economic standing of women is extremely advantageous to the capitalists. First of all, it lowers the overall wages bill. Secondly, it puts a downwards pressure on the wages of all workers by increasing competition among them, because under the system, labor is a commodity. And finally, it undermines solidarity between workers. Women have historically been regarded as a threat to the pay and conditions of men, although today bosses more often use this strategy with migrants and refugees. This divide and rule strategy obscures who is really responsible for decreasing conditions and pitiful wages. The bosses who have an interest in squeezing every cent out of workers that they can. So workers clearly have more of an interest in fighting in a united way against those who want to erode the rights they've won. And so have an interest in fighting against sexism materially, whether they are conscious of it yet or not. Bosses make use of other social and economic barriers to better take advantage of women in the workforce. The lack of easily accessible childcare and difficulties of working while caring with children reinforces structural discrimination. Because sexist ideas place great importance on women's roles as mothers, women are discriminated against in applying for jobs. A study from the University of Massachusetts showed that once they've got the job, professional women without children can earn the same as men, yet working mothers still lag behind. So fighting sexism is not just a matter of doing the right things in your relationships. Like even couples that, you know, badly want to rail against the oppressive shackles of gender are prevented by structural barriers. Since women earn less, economic necessity most often dictates that for working class families, it's women who are forced to drop out of the workforce to care for their young children. And as a consequence, women's earning capacity and financial independence are diminished. And so sexism at work connects with and reinforces another institution responsible for women's oppression, which is the family. The family is a vital economic and social unit for capitalism in that it takes on responsibility for reproducing the most important commodity to bosses, workers. Today, the family has ceased to play a productive economic role. While the peasant family was the center of production, working, and social life, the advent of capitalism has turned the family into a private sphere, independent of production. The Industrial Revolution nearly destroyed old family ties as all working class people, including children, were forced into long periods of dangerous labor that rendered any conception of family life impossible. In Australia, it took a concerted legal and ideological offensive imposed by the middle classes to impose the nuclear family on working class people to the ends of stemming high infant mortality and falling life expectancy of workers, which posed a dire threat to profit making in the long term. Conversely, Indigenous families were broken up with the removal of children of mixed race, disgracefully into the 1970s. And so this makes clear that the family is not a sacred, natural form of social organization, but an institution whose role in production has changed continuously according to the needs of capital. The ultra-conservative Fatherhood Foundation of Australia holds the same line on the central importance of the nuclear family, arguing that a lifelong committed relationship between a man and a woman is good for the economy. The anchor of the nuclear family helps married men have greater work commitment, lower quit rates, and healthier and more stable personal routines, which I'm sure to these people just means, you know, they've got a wife at home to slave after them. The rich and powerful in our society are also the most sexist, homophobic, and transphobic. It was only a few months ago, after all, that Scott Morrison actually labelled teachers that wanted to use kids' preferred pronouns as gender whisperers and complained about them. The capitalist class on a whole are invested in the traditional family because of its role in maintaining social order and keeping working class resistance at bay. Because we live in a system where the profits and privilege of the capitalist class is drawn directly from the exploitation of the 99%, a ready supply of exploitable labour power is of prime importance to the capitalists. They need workers willing and able to staff their factories, mines, and call centres, but at the lowest possible cost to them. Without human beings prepared to work and accept only a fraction of the value produced from their labour, there would be no profits. And so those who preside over the system want workers to be educated, trained, and ready to respect authority and accept the control of bosses and the state over every aspect of their lives. And so the family unit, with all the responsibilities of its members, is a reliable mechanism for this, helped by the fact that people often desire to replicate the family. The fact that workers readily carry out its function and accept that raising children is a matter of personal responsibility makes the family an extremely cost-effective mechanism. It also provides stability. Workers with mortgages, children to feed, and people that rely on them are less likely to stand up for themselves at work. The family can be seen to offer comfort from the drudgery and soullessness of wage labour, where our work is totally alienating and we have no control over what happens around us. So the vast majority of work performed in the home is done voluntarily, and it's by women. In advanced capitalist countries, where men and women spend equivalent hours working each week, women still perform around 72% of unpaid domestic labour in the home. The Australian Bureau of Statistics even recognises this, that women's domestic labour is equivalent to half of Australia's GDP. And so this is, of course, not a bill that bosses and politicians want to pay. The family is the prime site where people are initiated into gender roles also. Children learn in the family to accept as natural the division of labour between men and women, and taught that they should fulfil these roles with a sense of innate satisfaction from doing so. Such gender stereotypes just play an extremely destructive role in undermining the confidence, aspirations, and participation of women in public life. Young women learn quickly the importance of their attractiveness, not being too pushy or ambitious, and the virtue in performing selfless, unpaid labour in the home. Learned traits such as these translate to a difficulty in asserting themselves in every aspect of life, basically, from education to the workplace to negotiating relationships in their personal lives. Notions of gender excluded in the family also contribute to the oppression of LGBTI people, despite the prevalence of same-sex families today. The family remains the ideal by which the variations and so-called deviations are measured and continues to inform a sense of identity amongst all people, even those who reject the notions of the traditional family. Acts and relationships understood as queer have always taken place, yet it was under class society that they began to take on more social significance. Around the time of the Industrial Revolution, when the reproduction of the working class was a central concern for the capitalists, the family took on crucial importance to the detriment of homosexual men who were for the first time prosecuted for sodomy and indecent acts. So working class people expressing their sexuality in a way that was not directly conducive to procreation was threatening for the capitalists at a time of stagnating birth rates. And it's in this way that the family forms the basis for the oppression of those whose gender identity or sexuality does not conform to the norms of the family structure. So women's liberation is inseparable from that of LGBTI people. So the family, in sum, is a contradictory institution. Workers often cherish the family and supposed family values, despite it contributing to their subordination and the fact that it can be a site of violence, abuse, and unhappiness. So the seemingly eternal experience of sexism begs the question, well, how can we fight it and crush women's oppression for good? To begin to answer this, I want to first dispel some of the illusions in methods for women's liberation that fall short of revolutionary conclusions. The first commonly spouted idea is that progress can be made for women's rights by merely getting more women into positions of power. I know, it's like silly. The women politicians, CEOs, and police commissioners are a win for the sisterhood and advance the rights of women everywhere. Julia Gillard, often hailed as a liberal feminist icon for her famous misogyny speech, was no ally to working class women. The very same day that speech was given, Gillard cut payments to single parents, throwing many single mothers into poverty. She is also responsible for locking up refugee women and their children in concentration camps, presiding over the occupation and theft of Aboriginal women's lands, and backing the disastrous intervention into Afghanistan. So women like this are part of the problem. They have a direct interest in upholding capitalism due to their class position, their power, and prestige that comes along with it. But another prominent argument is that don't we just need education? You know, backwards workers just need to be educated out of their bigotry and acknowledge their privilege. Well, I think first we can see that sexism is not just the result of ignorance. Actually, the most highly educated individuals in our society are some of the worst offenders. And if you need any proof of this, listen to, you know, Rhodes Scholar Tony Abbott speak for more than 30 seconds. History shows that the way that sexism is challenged is not by enlightened individuals lecturing from on high, but by people being convinced of the need to struggle against all forms of oppression and share solidarity with the oppressed. So this is not to say that we shouldn't call out bigotry. Socialists are for taking up every fight and against every injustice, no matter how small. But it is to say that people need to be convinced themselves of the reasons to stand against oppression. And the main way to do this is by engaging people in struggle and developing class consciousness. So Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto that the only group in society fundamentally capable of challenging the inequality, war, and oppression are those impacted by these things, the working class. The horrors of capitalist society push all of its victims to resist, inevitably, but the working class in particular has the capacity to be the grave diggers of capitalism. This is because workers are forced to cooperate to run our workplaces. This brings together people of all different backgrounds. To win any positive reforms from the rich and powerful, workers need to act collectively. We hold immense power as workers in that when we withhold our labour, all profits start to dry up. In their role as unpaid labourers and carers in the home, women are isolated, atomized, and hold no social power. If they stopped doing this care work, those who would bear the brunt of it would actually be children and the elderly. So it's in their role as workers that women have power, as they are part of a class that needs collective struggle to win anything good. And it's also the case that the workers' movement has been more instrumental in winning gains for women than women organising alone. The workers' movement has tended to take up the fight against sexism because their enemies, the bosses and the government, are also the ones responsible for women's oppression. The more commitment and experience a union has in fighting, the more likely it is to recognise the importance of issues of social justice, to weaken the bosses and strengthen the bonds of solidarity amongst all workers that is necessary for victory. This is how you can explain the fact that it has been the most militant unions, not female dominated, who have been at the forefront of struggles for social justice in Australia. The Militant Builders Labourers Federation, for example, was a male dominated union that struck for women's right to work on building sites, as well as for the rights of gay students, Aboriginal rights and the environment back in the 1970s. This was because the BLF understood that an injury to one worker or oppressed group was an injury to all. And so during times of struggle, women's participation is a political necessity. In the Great British Miners' Strike of 1984, the active and leading role of women in rural mining communities was obvious. Without their support, ranging from helping to hold the picket line against violent police repression and beating back scabs, traveling the country to raise money for the strike fund and organizing strike kitchens, the strike would not have been able to last. Isolated as they are, mining communities tend to be traditional in attitudes, yet the strike altered what was understood as common sense ideas about women's roles, like almost overnight. A woman described the change in her daughter as this. Before, Annette was a hardworking housewife, demure, shy even. Now she has altered beyond recognition. She is a stranger to me. Sometimes I do not feel I know the person before me. And so Annette replied curtly, "Don't be daft, ma'am. I've just discovered I'm not the stupid female I always thought I was." So the miners' strike was significant in that it raised the questions of solidarity with other oppressed groups as well. When gay and lesbian groups reached out to support the strikers, the miners repaid them in kind. They understood that queer people and the striking miners were being attacked by the same media, police, and politicians as them. They saw their struggles were interconnected and so saw the need to stand together. The miners not only accepted homosexuals at a time of, you know, extreme conservatism and the height of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, but supported them politically, with a substantial contingent of miners marching at the front of the London demonstration for gay pride, which is something that continues to this day as well. So these sorts of struggles change not only how workers conceive of each other, but also themselves. It's only by fighting back with the clear aim of challenging the social conditions around them that the reality of oppression and suffering can be fought and ended. This necessitates women developing the confidence and fighting spirit to defy patterns of submission and tired tropes of how they should behave. It's important for workers to take up a fighting stance against oppression. But the only way that we can win a society completely free of women's oppression is by smashing the system that creates the material basis for it in the first place. Sexism runs deep in the structures of capitalism. So we need to actually challenge these existing structures. The highest form of such a challenge is in a working class revolution, with the aim of transferring political power from the parasitic minority to the democratic control of the working class. And so a successful victory over the capitalist class requires the support and involvement of women. Pitching such a decisive battle necessitates women's organization as leaders. And in times of revolution, it is some of the most oppressed groups that actually come to be the staunchest fighters. The greatest example of working class revolution and workers' power was Russia in 1917, which pulled Russia out of World War I and legislated advances for women still not achieved in much of the world today, which was kicked off by women textile workers going on strike on International Working Women's Day. Taking over and reorganizing production in the interests of humanity couldn't simply be enforced from above. This power would involve a total restructuring of society, contingent on new structures of workers' power. This sort of bottom-up organizing provides the basis for mass collective decision-making about how the resources and productive capacity of society should be used. This crucially allows the oppressed and exploited to take control of and transform social conditions, to be organized along the lines of human need and not profit. Things like reordering public transport, food production, and manufacturing would necessitate mass participation. And so workers' control of society would also mean organizing essential services in a way that makes sense and relieves working class women of mind-numbing domestic work so that they can be involved in political organization. Communal kitchens, laundries, and nurseries could be established, as in the Russian example. The Russian Revolution also established political rights to be achieved in much of the rest of the world, including, you know, decriminalizing homosexuality, secularizing marriage and divorce, and legalizing abortion all the way back in 1917 and 18. And so this shows that rather than any linear notions of progress, the dismantling of the oppressive structures within capitalism can actually make massive strides forward for the rights of the oppressed, seemingly overnight. Revolution led by the working class is both a practical and an ideological struggle. Marx wrote that revolution is necessary, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only succeed in a revolution in ridding itself of all the muck of ages, you know, the backwards ideas that capitalism imposes on us, and become fit to rule. And so the task of rebuilding society in a more sane and just way throws up all different questions. Workers will be forced to confront any previously held backwards ideas, and the newfound confidence of the oppressed will leave them reluctant to put up with any bigotry. With the genuinely democratic nature of society, workers would have no reason to impose the idea of the nuclear family or maintain any form of sexual inequality. By spending their days labouring for the common good with a sense of purpose and not just to line the pockets of a boss, there would be no sense of alienation and no material basis for workers to take up reactionary ideas and point the blame for their misery at other oppressed groups. So a working class revolution to overthrow capitalism is necessary to liberate women. The process of a revolution is crucial to organizing society in line with the wishes and needs of the majority, and to change workers' ideas and make them fit to rule. We live in an awful exploitative system where every day people bear the brunt of, you know, the injustice of economic collapse, war, climate crisis, and everyday oppression. But working class people always fight back. And so what is needed now is the type of organization to push these ideas and intervene in struggles all the time, to argue that workers could run the world in a much better way than those who sit over this awful system. So to finish up, I want to look back to the Polish struggle. The Polish women won. They were granted. They were granted what will hopefully be the first of many concessions from a far-right government, you know, just obliterating the idea that what we need to do is just wait around for the next election to come and vote in more progressive politicians. Like structural change can be made from below. And so one demonstrator said, now it's not only about the abortion rights struggle at this point, it's about overthrowing the government. Yeah, and so that was from an undergraduate student named Kasia in Poland. The struggle has wound up for now, but the impact it's had on the women involved and Polish society actually is unquantifiable. The hundreds of thousands involved won't forget the lessons learnt anytime soon. But yeah, we shouldn't just say good for them. The result, the victory, is the result of the efforts of real people who decided they weren't going to stand by while the government attacked them. The same government I mentioned that had already attacked their LGBTI comrades, you know, had slandered immigrants and fear-mongered, and prioritise the health of the economy over the health of its people, like, all year. So we should take inspiration from their courage, determination, and make the choice for ourselves. Actually, will you watch the horrors, inevitable horrors of the system unfold, or will you get organised and fight?